Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, we've got a little late start here due to a technicality on my end, but let's just jump right into it. All right, today's show, part policy and part theory. Let's look at the policy. Let's an update on recent shows we've done here on inflation, a topic of growing interest here as the economy reopens, and also an update on what I call infrastructure follies, the smoke and mirrors game going on with the infrastructure bill and the tax proposals of the Biden administration and the spending proposals. It's a real smoke and mirrors game. What you see is not what you're going to get. And it deserves some debunking here. So I want to give an update on that. But if you want to follow some of the earlier commentaries I've made on both these topics, inflation, emerging inflation, and infrastructure, just listen to some of the podcasts here that we've had in the last couple of weeks. And also check out my blog where I've written a couple articles on the same topic here, jackrasmus.com. In the second half of the show, though, I want to do something different. I want to begin a series of shows and commentaries on economic theory and try to keep it as simple as possible, as non-mathematic as possible. And we're going to start with Keynes. What did Keynes actually say? And there's a distinction between Keynes's economics and Keynesian economics that you hear about. They are not the same thing. There is an overlap, a kind of congruence, but there's a big difference between Keynesian economics and what Keynes actually said. So we're going to do a little preview at the second half of the show on this topic of what did Keynes actually say about the economy, about recessions, about business cycles. And I think you're going to be quite surprised. And then we're going to do follow that up in subsequent weeks on what did Marx actually say? And then we're going to do a third one. What did Adam Smith actually say? You know, for 6 years now, every year, I've taught a course at my college here, St. Mary's in California, the economics department, just reading the original works of these three economists in the original, not what third parties have said and interpreted that most people get their understanding what Keynes, Marx, and Smith said, but the originals. We just read the three books, and that's it, in the original. And I've done this for 6 years in a row now, and, you know, I think I kind of know what these guys have been saying, and it's quite different from what you get repeated in the media, in the media, in the press, and even in much of the academics, economists' views in the courses they teach, so forth, on these three economists. You know, most of these guys have never read Marx. They've read little pieces of Smith, and they've read a bastardized version of Keynes. I haven't read Keynes's original works. It's amazing. It's amazing. Three great economists, and most economists have never read their works in the original. And, of course, they peddle out all these misrepresentations about what these guys actually said. And you'll see that all three of them are really quite radical in their analysis of what capitalism really, capitalist economy really is and how it really behaves. So I think it's time to try to debunk some of this misrepresentations of what these people really said. And have some shows on that, and we'll sort of stick our analysis into our practical policy descriptions of what's going on, you know, with the tax policy and the fiscal policy and monetary policy and so forth, okay? By the way, you know, Bidenomics is beginning to look more and more like neoliberalism. His campaign promises kind of looked like they were going to diverge from neoliberal economics, but it's beginning to look more and more like a continuation of neoliberal economics and economic neoliberal policy. But we'll talk about that as we continue in our analysis and talk about what these guys, these economists, actually said and what the misrepresentations of what they've said actually are. And the misrepresentations become the justifications for the policies in neoliberalism, right? It's not these economists, it's the misrepresentations, the distortions, the perversions of what they actually said. And that's what I call economic ideology, the misrepresentations of the reality, of the facts. That is what economic ideology is about, as opposed to economic science. You know, when you observe the data and you make conclusions and hypotheses from the data and you come up, well, you know, with, you know, your explanations based upon observations and the data, that's economic science. But economic ideology is really about misrepresentation of what has been said. And there are all kinds of language games and logical games that are played in order to create these misrepresentations and make it look like it's reality. All right, so when we talk about these three economists over the coming weeks, we'll distinguish the ideology from the science, both in their work and the critics of their work in particular. Okay, so that's the preview. Let's jump into the economy per se here and all this talk about inflation. And then we'll talk a little bit about updates here on the fiscal policy follies. Okay, inflation. The report came out this week for May inflation, Consumer Price Index. As I pointed out, just a brief commentary here on the side, the CPI does not measure inflation in the economy. The true inflation is measured by other economic price indexes, most likely, you know, the PCE index, Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, that the Fed uses. The CPI is a measure of urban cost of living. That's not the same as inflation. It is an overrepresentation of inflation that you will get more accurately in the PCE that the Fed uses. Okay, let's get the CPI. For now, let's just assume that the CPI is a measure of inflation. How much inflation have we really been getting here? What does it look like we may have of it? Okay. Well, the CPI index for May came out, and the media made a big deal about it, saying, oh, we have a 4.8% year on year. You know, their report, they're rounding it out at 5. Inflation last month. In other words, inflation is rising at 5% a year. The most since 2008, okay? And when you strip out what's called headline inflation, in other words, food cost and energy cost, gasoline mostly, from the total CPI, you get the core inflation. When you add food and energy, you get headline inflation. Okay, so we got headline inflation of 4.8%. Year on year, last month, the most since 2008. By the way, in 2008, it was mostly gasoline prices. Yeah, we had a huge run-up because of speculation in global oil commodity markets in the first half of 2008, and that drove most of the inflation during that time. But anyway, you know, 4.8%. year on year. In other words, what they're doing is looking at May of 2020, last year, and saying, okay, it's gone up 4.8%, or roughly 0.6% per month. 4.8%, 0.6% per month, every month, over the past 12 months. The core inflation, if you take out energy and food, 3.8%. 3.8%. Doesn't sound that great, does it? Not to me, 3.8%. Look, that 3.8% or 4.8% core headline, right, is based upon a benchmark, right, a base rate that was in effect last April and May. April and May. In other words, you take that base, and how much did it increase? Well, the base in March, April, and May was deflating. Prices were falling. So the base is inordinately low because we had deflation, price declines. So you're measuring year to year from April, May last year, of falling prices, and you're measuring using that as your base. So it looks like inflation now is higher than normal. Even the New York Times said, quote, the year-ago figure was depressed by shutdowns, so the current readings look large by comparison. Yeah. Very important. What is the base month that you're using to estimate your year-on-year CPI inflation rate? The base was deflating prices, so that now it looks larger than ordinary. If prices were not falling last April, May, because of the shutdown, the inflation rate today, year on year, would be much less than the 4.8. Look, there's not that much inflation really going on. Period. But, you know, the media is really hyping it all, aren't they? And the Republican senators and others, businessmen, and, you know, jumping on that bandwagon and saying, oh, we got all this inflation because people have so much money now because of the stimulus programs and because they're getting unemployment benefits that they're driving up the prices. There's too much cash in households or too much money chasing too few goods, right? Too much household income or too much money chasing too few goods are the classic misrepresentations of why we have inflation. Remember, misrepresentations are economic ideology. Okay? Well, let's debunk those two demand-side causes of inflation. First of all, yeah, a lot of money has been pumped into the economy by the Federal Reserve, $120 billion per month continuing in 1 year, $4 trillion in 1 year pumped into the banks, and the banks then shuffle the money, some of it off into loans, into investors and corporations and so forth. And where has that money gone is the question. Has it gone into people buying goods and services that show up in the CPI? No. That excess money has mostly gone into financial markets and mergers and acquisitions, or it's being hoarded by businesses as they prepare to start buying back their stock again and paying out dividends again. Or it's being hoarded or going offshore for investments. In other words, it's not going into households to spend excessively on goods and services. It's going into financial asset markets mostly. And yes, we have bubbles in the stock market. You know, you keep hearing about all these day traders buying all these what's called meme stocks, you know, GameStop, AMC, and it's spreading now to other companies speculating. Well, they got an excess. Yeah, they got an excess of income on hand. And so do 10% of the households, the upper top level of the households. This is where all the savings has really gone. And it's being hoarded, and it's being used to speculate in financial markets mostly. Not totally, but mostly, right? Or it's being hoarded by businesses, or they're borrowing the money in order to use it to issue their own corporate bonds to raise money to pay dividends to their shareholders. You see a lot of financial manipulation going on here, but it's not bleeding over into goods and services that the CPI measures. You see, the CPI does not measure financial prices, stocks and bonds and so forth. Those are not in the CPI. Just goods and services are in the CPI. So, you know, it's pretty phony that there's too much excessive income driving up demand and therefore price. You know, economists say inflation is a function of supply and demand, right? Not always. And supply and demand are just symptoms of more fundamental causes that can be interpreted through the concepts of supply and demand. But it's not necessarily just supply and demand per se. It's what goes on below supply and demand that determines prices that gets reflected in supply and demand. Okay, so it's not a demand-driven problem. It's not. It really isn't. You know, there's not that much excess savings going into median and below households that would increase their purchases significantly to drive up prices, particularly on services, you know, over the past year. So is it a supply-side problem then? To some extent, yes. It is a supply-driven, not a demand-driven cause of inflation, which, keep in mind, 4.8% is based on a deflation and prices base effect, they call that, in last April and May. Right? The 4.8% would be less than 4% if you weren't really looking at deflating prices in as the shutdown occurred last April and May. Okay, so keep that always in mind. The figure is not really 4.85%. It's well less than 4%. And the normal is about 2.2%. You know, so what do we got? You know, 1 to 2% excess inflation going on? Is that, a real major problem that we should cut all the stimulus programs? No. But let's turn to supply. Let's look at supply here. Yeah, there are problems on the supply side. You know, in basic economics, excess demand may drive up prices, and a decline in supply will, all things equal, drive up prices. They move in opposite directions. So if it's not an increase in demand, oh, is it a problem of a reduction in supplies? To some extent, yes. Okay, supply chains, global supply chains were broken during the pandemic, during 2020, and they still haven't put them back together again. In other words, semi-finished goods and raw materials and even other goods from other countries being imported into the U.S., there's a problem. The flow is not as great as it was in 2019. There is a shortage in many cases. A good example is shipping costs here. There's a real container shortage. You know, a lot of the containers that go on these ships were mothballed because there was no demand globally last year. And so, the containers were mothballed. A lot of ships were mothballed. And now they're trying to take them out of mothball storage and get them going again. And there's a shortage of containers. So that's driving up import prices of goods, and goods particularly, and raw materials. That's a supply problem. It has nothing to do with excess income by households. As there are such a supply problem in shipping resources, particularly, oil and iron ore and other commodities, but also semi-finished goods. As there's a problem with this, you've got speculators buying up the supply, buying up legal claims on what exists. That's called commodities futures trading. Commodities here being, you know, oil and gas and iron ore and aluminum ore and copper ore and even food of various kinds, you know, wheat and grains and so forth. Speculators, when there's a shortage, cause a greater shortage by claiming and holding on to the claims on these commodities. And they do that in the hope and trying to drive up the price of these commodities, and it works. You see, when there are shortages for real reasons, like containers and so forth, the speculators exacerbate the problem by buying up the claims called commodity futures of the shortages and cause even greater shortages, right? Look, the amount of oil in the world does not fluctuate by huge amounts from day to day or week to week, and the demand for it does not fluctuate in the short term great enough to justify, for example, the price for a barrel of crude oil going from $50 to $75 in just a few weeks. There's no way supply or demand moves that quickly. You get this price swings in oil and other things because of speculation. Global speculators are behind most of the short-term volatility in commodity futures prices. Okay, so, you know, that's a supply problem, a speculation on a natural supply issue, exacerbating it. Inventories is a supply issue. You know, businesses keep certain amount of inventories to smooth out their sales and their revenues. But last year, they cut the inventories dramatically because there was no demand for these goods. I'm talking about physical goods, durable goods, non-durable goods, not services so much. But inventories went way down. They collapsed. And that problem with inventories, insufficient inventories, continued into the first quarter of this year. So, you know, when the economy finally begins to open up, as it has here in April and May, there's been an inventory shortage. And a shortage means they can charge higher prices, which they've been doing. And then we have specific issues of inflation, like let's take homes, residential housing. Lots of problems going on there, but mostly a supply problem once again, the lack of commodities like lumber and other resources needed. And I would add, you've got speculators like BlackRock. BlackRock buying up entire neighborhoods, buying up the homes, entire neighborhoods, causing a shortage for people who then want to buy homes that exist, right? That drives up the prices as well. So you get speculators in the housing market who are doing the same thing that global commodity speculators are doing. And it's all a supply-side problem. It's supply side to some extent. Very little demand, mostly supply. But I'll tell you, it's mostly neither supply and demand. What we got is price gouging going on by businesses across the board in an attempt to test the market, how much they can raise their prices as the, you know, as the economy opens up, as it rebounds, how much can they raise prices to recoup their revenue losses of last year? Has nothing to do with supply or demand. It's just plain old profit. Profit through price increase attempts to recoup the revenue loss and profits of last year. Let's look at something here. many of you have probably gotten your bills for the last couple of months. You look at your water bill, your electric bill, your natural gas, utilities in general. Boy, are they rising. Double digits, sometimes 20%. 20% increases. Is that because there's less electric supply or less water? No. Are we consuming more water and more electricity? No. This is just price gouging. They're doing it because they can, because there's this general psychological message going out that, oh, prices are going up. So these utilities are taking advantage of it and jumping on the bandwagon and raising prices, you know, as a cover. They got the cover now, and they're doing it. What about insurances, especially auto insurance and home insurance? Again, double digit, right? Are home insurable costs going up? You know, yours truly, in the last 13 months, I've had a 50% increase in my home insurance and an increase in the auto insurance as well. Are there fewer cars? More cars? No, they're doing it because they can. You know, last year, the insurance companies, auto and home insurance, they didn't reduce their prices, even though they were able to make a lot of profits because the claims went way down. It was a banner year for auto insurance companies in 2020. They made a lot more money. They kept your price the same, right? And they had far, far fewer claims. Well, now they're raising prices to make super profits on top of the profits they made. Is that supply and demand? No. That's just plain old price gouging. What about rents? What about rents? Yeah, rents are going up too. Why, are there more people wanting to rent? Demand and rent? No. What you got is evictions going on, and the landlords are using the fact that people are being thrown out of their rents as an excuse to raise them once again. So rents are going up, and you've got to distinguish between actual rent prices and what's called owner equivalent rents. Well, what the hell is that? Owner equivalent rents? How does that show up in the CPI index? Well, I'll tell you. Part of gross domestic product and part of inflation, CPI, is what would people who own their homes charge in rents? They're not actually charging anything, but the number goes up as the value of the homes go up because of speculation driving home prices up. They raise imputed rent. They call this imputed rents. It doesn't actually happen, but they add that to the GDP, and therefore it's added to the inflation indexes here. How much would owners who aren't renting their houses actually rent it because the value of their houses are rising? Oh, that inflation's going up too, just as actual rents are going up. Has nothing to do with supply and demand, unless you want to argue supply is driving up new home prices and therefore driving up the price of owner equivalent rent prices. Okay, tuition and fees. Colleges jacking up the tuition and fees significantly now for next year. Why? Well, because last year they lost all this lucrative foreign student business. You see, they charge foreign students, which is a huge number. We allow into the U.S. every year because they pay the full amount. You see, they don't get college loans. These are wealthy people from outside the U.S. send their kids to colleges and university in the U.S., you know, from China in Asia and Europe, Latin America, and so forth. And that, of course, drives up college and tuition prices. Last year, they didn't get this lucrative segment of their total revenue, and now they're jacking up prices, colleges, university, once again, because they had these big losses last year. You know how much it costs to go to a private university per year now? You know? about $75,000 a year. Can you believe that? $75,000 a year. It's going to cost you over $300,000 to send your kid to an Ivy League college or one of the other independents, you know, Stanford or whatever, if you could afford it. $300,000 plus, that's going to go up, you know. After 4 years from now, it's going to be at least $400,000, $100,000 a year. I mean, that is such an outrageous thing. And, of course, those prices drag up the prices of tuition and fees at the public universities as well, because they want to be competitive. You know, they don't charge quite as much, but they use it as an excuse to raise their tuition and fees as well. Is that because of supply and demand? No. That has nothing to do with either. Let's take airlines, right? If you look at last month's 4.8% CPI increase, it was concentrated largely in airline fares and used autos, transport, in other words, right? How much? Airline fares went up 24.1%, airline fares. As the economy is opening, airlines are testing the market to see how much they can get away with in jacking up their prices, you know, and see how much people desperate will still pay for it. Is it the demand that's driving it, or are they just raising it up, you know, to, do what they can to get as much as they can from people going back, flying airlines again. But, you know, the total amount of airline travel is still well below what it was in 2019. Why, with that much less in 2019, are they charging that much more in 2021? The demand is less than it was in 19. Well, because they're opening it up and they're trying to get away with it. And by the way, you know, consider this. The airlines were given $50 billion in subsidies last year. You know, $25 billion last spring, and then another $25 billion again later in the year. $50 billion in subsidies. They didn't lose anything. You know, they did quite well last year. Now with the opening, they hope to do even better. So much of that CPI was airline fares increases, 24%, and the price of used autos up almost 30% year on year. Well, why used autos? Oh, because this year, in 2021, the auto companies went on strike, you see. What they did was cut production on new cars, claiming that they didn't have sufficient semiconductor chips to produce in these new cars. There was a problem in Taiwan, where a lot of these mass-produced chips come from. And they used that as an excuse to say, oh, we don't have enough chips here to produce our new cars, so we're cutting back production. Well, you know, it coincided with the infrastructure bill being offered by Biden that provided for a $50 billion subsidy to the auto companies for chip production in the future. Once it looked like the $50 billion subsidy was going to be passed by the Senate a week or so ago, you know, it was a done deal, all but a done deal, $50 billion subsidy for the auto companies. Miraculously, GM says, oh, we're opening production. Well, wait a minute. You tell you don't have enough chips right now. The subsidy bill is for future. You're not getting that next week or in June. But all of a sudden, General Motors says, oh, we're going to up production. Look, it was a business strike. It was a capitalist strike that they didn't have enough chips. It was phony. It was manipulated in order to say there wasn't enough cars new cars. And that lack of new cars forced people to go buy used autos. And the used autos and truck prices escalated significantly. You can trace the used auto price increase in last month's CPI to manipulation of the production and semiconductor chips and legislation by the auto companies themselves. Okay. Last month, there's also some increase in furniture prices and some in services as labor shortages, workers in services not coming back as fast as everyone expected them to, reducing how much services could be provided, and therefore these companies, service companies, jacked up their prices to offset the lack of volume of sales. You see, there's two ways to make profits fundamentally. You either cut costs, three ways, cut costs, or you increase your volume of sales, or you raise your price, or all the above, right? So this is a game a lot of services are playing. They're saying, oh, we can't get the workers, what we got to do is try to make up in prices for those who are actually coming into the market buying the services. Right? So this is a supply issue, once again, a labor supply issue in this case. So this is a problem. But why are they not coming back, right? Is it because they're getting too much unemployment insurance? No. They're not coming back because many of these employers are offering them only limited hours of work, one. And that means lower weekly earnings for workers coming back into these services. Or they can't find or afford child care if they got kids. Child care costs have ballooned, right? Because there's nobody, there's no real child care services market or system in this country, unlike in Europe. It just doesn't exist. It's catch as catch can. And the greater demand for child care to be able to go back. The other problem with workers not going back has to do with the school systems not really opening up. You know, they say they're opened up, for 2 hours, for 2 days a week? That's what a lot of these school districts have done. Well, you still got to stay home, right? You still got to stay home and watch your kids and teach your kids, you know, and that means millions of particularly women not being able to go back into the labor force because they have to teach their kids. They have to play teacher. There's lots of reasons why workers are not coming back into the service sector in particular. It's not a manufacturing problem explains why there's a labor shortage. But the point is the labor shortage is being used as an excuse by companies in services to jack up their prices. In other words, if you look at all that, you know, I've just described, there's a lot of causes, specific causes, that have nothing to do with supply and demand that are behind this surge in prices, which isn't that great, by the way, because it's on a base months of deflation, falling prices, last April and May. It's not all that great, but it's mostly price gouging and some real supply side issues that are behind the inflation to the extent it does exist. It's not an excess demand that Republicans may want you to believe in order to shoot down the spending. Well, let's look at the spending. Let's look at the spending fiscal policy update here, right? Well, as we've said, Biden has cut his proposal to $1 trillion from $2.2 trillion now, right? And the next game being played is that part of that $1 trillion will be money already authorized to be spent in other bills and legislations. In other words, the transit bill, transport bill, $304 billion, already authorized. They'll include that. They'll double count it, in other words, as part of their $1 trillion infrastructure bill. The Republicans have proposed $394 billion already authorized, plus they want to transfer $350 billion authorized in the COVID relief bill for state and local governments. So, you know, about $750 billion of their $928 or so billion is really money already authorized. Yeah, smoke and mirror games here, right? And what has been Biden's response to this? Well, moving towards their position, right? And breaking out elements of the $1 trillion and passing legislation by those breakout smaller bills, most notably the $250 billion in infrastructure, original infrastructure proposal that's going to subsidies to manufacturing companies, tech companies, to develop technologies and compete with China. You see, $250 billion of that is being passed separately. What's also occurring is all the alternative energy proposals in the original infrastructure bill are being stripped out now. Originally, it was $174 billion that was supposed to go to the government buying electric buses, right, and the government building, paying for 500,000 electric charging stations and other subsidies to the auto companies. Well, those are subsidies because now they don't have to do it. Well, that's been reduced, and bills going through Congress now to $8.1 billion, from $174 to $8.1 billion. That's all $4 billion the government's going to buy electric buses, right? And just minimal expenditures, maybe $4 billion, to get the build out of charging, electric charging stations going. We're going from $174 billion to $8 billion. Well, that's a trend going on behind the scenes. The electric alternative energy proposals are being stripped out and dropped by Biden. And they are breaking out the subsidies to manufacturing and R&D and so forth separately to get those passed, because Republicans are all for corporate subsidies, right? The Republican offer, $750 billion of it is just moving the money around from already authorized expenditures. So there's really, you know, maybe $200 billion. That's all they're talking about? Yeah, that's all. And because of these cuts, in the spending, now Biden is cutting his proposal for tax hikes. We've got this move to cut from raising a corporate tax rate to 28% from 21%, right? He's dropped it. There's no rise in taxation on corporations now. Biden has given up $850 billion of what he previously proposed in tax hikes. Well, if you're cutting your spending, you don't need that much tax hikes, do you? Right? So he's cutting it out. And he gave a signal, I believe, that he's willing to go to a 15% flat tax. You know, the government, U.S., agreed with the Europeans to tax globally 15%. 15% global tax, right? I believe that Biden has given the signal that he will consider, maybe not immediately, but he will consider a 15% flat tax on domestic corporations as well. In other words, he'll cut it from 21% to 15%. I think he's given this signal. Well, you know, the defenders of Biden and the Democrats, you know, continually say, oh, no, he only said 21%. No. You know, look what Reuters, and I've quoted Reuters, said. He didn't say 15% only for foreign agreements, foreign offshore tax rate. No, he said 15%, period. So I think we're going to be facing a further tax cut for corporations. And the next attack will be on the personal income tax increase. You know, there's a proposal to raise the capital gains tax for wealthy individuals and to have them pay 39% instead of 37% basic rate if they make over $1 million in income. Watch that pared down as well, right? That's the next topic. The way to understand what's going on with the taxation maneuvers is that, in my mind, Joe Manchin of West Virginia is the point man in the Democratic Party to drive down the spending and to drive down the proposed tax hikes. But the corporate wing of the Democratic Party, I think, is largely aligned with Joe Manchin. The corporate wing runs the party, Democratic Party. Biden is the, you know, the candidate, the person, you know, in the corporate wing, always has been. And I think they're doing a hard cop, soft cop on us here with Manchin demanding that there be no corporate tax hike. And now there isn't, of course. That's taken out. And we'll see whether this let's roll back the tax proposals bleeds over into the personal income tax of the wealthy individuals. That's inevitable. You're going to see that happen as well. And now we got this bipartisan group here that's taken over the next phase of the maneuvers in the shell game. Bipartisan, the Republicans, you know, led by Romney, and the Democrats, I think it's Manchin here, and they're proposing their own. And they're claiming, oh, $579 billion in new infrastructure spending, right? Well, you know, when you agree to include $304 billion from the Highway Transport Fund, and you need to cut some of the money, take some of the money that was already allocated under COVID to state and local governments out, you know, pare that down, well, then you get in of already authorized spending plus the $579 billion, there's your $1 trillion or so that Biden has agreed to, already moved to, without corresponding moves by the Republicans, except for them moving the money around, right? So as I predicted weeks ago here, you know, you get a settlement around $1 trillion, but a good part of that, looks like half of that at least, is going to be already authorized money that are going to claim as part of the infrastructure bill, and maybe $500-600 billion of new money, which is going to go to traditional infrastructure. Traditional, you know, roads and ports and so forth. And in other words, all the alternative energy and subsidies and so forth that were proposed in the original infrastructure bill are going to be stripped out, right? And it's this three-way game going on. It's not just the Democrats versus the Republican solid corporation, you know, advocates here and wealthy advocates. And in the Democratic Party, you got the progressive wing, which is not the majority, not in control of that party, negotiating with the Manchins and the Bidens, right? You got three-way negotiations going on within the Democratic Party, as well as between Democrats and Republicans, between Schumer and McConnell, right? So, you know, that's really what's going on here. It's a shell game. This fiscal policy infrastructure is a shell game, and of course, part of the shell game is to cut the tax proposals. Cut the tax proposals as you cut the spending as well. What's more important to them? You know, is it cutting taxes or cutting the spending? Well, they're both two sides of the same coin. Can't have one without the other. All right, that's the update on fiscal policy. I want to turn, there's not that much time left, but I want to say something about what we're going to be talking about in future weeks here about Keynes. We're going to start with Keynes's economics. What does Keynes really say, you know? And why is it so different from what Keynesian economics is? Just a little preview here. Where we're going the next week, we'll dive deeper into Keynes. And maybe in even the subsequent week as well, and then Marx, and then Adam Smith. Okay, some things you didn't know about Keynes's economics. Keynes concluded his main work, The General Theory of Employment and Interest and Money, which he wrote in 1935, he concluded the chapter with a summary chapter in which he said, there are two fundamental failures of capitalist economics, capitalist economy, two fundamental failures. Now, after all his analysis, he said, capitalism cannot solve, does not want to solve these two problems. One, ever-increasing income inequality. It's an inherent condition in capitalism that inequality will continue to worsen. There may be periods, you know, when there's a crisis and they got to throw more money at the working class, you know, like in the 30s and 40s. And a little bit here in the last year, a little bit, nothing like the Great Depression and the New Deal. Biden's policy is not New Deal 2.0. But anyway, income inequality, fundamental problem. Another fundamental problem is chronic unemployment. Capitalism cannot and does not really want to solve the unemployment problem. And, you know, this is a global economy. You got to think about inequality and unemployment on a global basis, not just in the U.S. If you look at capitalism globally, unemployment is rising. If you look at it globally, income inequality is rising everywhere. You know, it's not just income inequality in the U.S. It's in Europe. It's in China. It's everywhere. You know, this is a fundamental problem of capitalism. Oh, you never heard that about Keynes? No, I'm sure you didn't. And if you took economics in college, they didn't say a word about that. Well, in fact, most economics professors have never read The General Theory, let alone his other works, like Treatise on Money, written before that. No, they haven't read it. What they've called Keynesian economics is based on third-party criticisms. Keynesian economics is cherry-picking parts of Keynes's economics that are useful and adding to it mostly pre-Keynes's economic analysis, pre-Keynes, that Keynes himself criticized vehemently. He rejected much of pre-Keynesian economics, or what's sometimes called neoclassical economics. It was the basis for writing his book, The General Theory. But what's Keynesian economics is a bastardized version of parts of Keynes added to much of what Keynes criticized. That's Keynesian economics, you see. We sometimes call this the neoclassical synthesis. Yeah, well, we're going to get into what Keynes said. One point here in this preview, and I'll continue in more detail next week. One point, pre-Keynes, neoclassical economics, argued that the way to get out of the Depression was to cut business costs, including wages, taxes, and interest rates. Keynes says that's all ass backwards. That's not the way to get out. Anyway, we're running out of time here, and we'll pick this theme up next week. You know, what is Keynes's economics compared to pre-Keynes and today's Keynesian economics?